Podcast, episode 75. A few things here to talk about today, so let's get started. At 5:09 p.m. on Tuesday, January 10th, CNN's Jake Tapper took to the air. Here's what he had to say.
A CNN exclusive, CNN has learned that the nation's top intelligence officials provided information to President-elect Donald Trump and to President Barack Obama last week about claims of Russian efforts to compromise President-elect Trump. The information was provided as part of last week's classified intelligence briefings regarding Russian efforts to undermine the U.S. election.
With him were fellow journalists Jim Sciutto and Evan Perez, and along with Carl Bernstein. These three correspondents just published an article headlined, "Intel Chiefs Presented Trump with Claims of Russian Efforts to Compromise Him." This after BuzzFeed published a 35-page document detailing specific unverified and potentially unverifiable allegations of contact between Trump aides and Russian operatives and graphic claims of sexual acts documented by the Russians, and that's a direct quotation. BuzzFeed editor-in-chief Ben Smith defended the decision to publish unverified intelligence data, but he was wrong to make that call and wrong to defend it in the manner he did. It was a horrible mistake, and I suspect one day he'll see why. Extraordinary allegations require extraordinary proofs, and this is nothing if not an extraordinary story. Smith's defense that he was merely letting the public in on a discussion already happening at the highest levels of government and media sounds generous enough, but do the people need to hear what folks are whispering in the hallways, even if those are hallways high up in society? Gossip is gossip, especially in a town like Washington. And fact is fact, there is a difference, and journalists should know this. It's really not all that complicated. Even the Columbia Journalism Review got it wrong. The managing editor, Vanessa Ghazari, argued that BuzzFeed took a well-established approach. Release what you can when you have it, and see what new leads it generates. That's a quotation. This may be a good argument for scooping a story, but it's a horrible argument from an ethical standpoint. And how about this? And again, a direct quotation. Some critics seem to be saying that unless the information in an intelligence briefing or other leaked documents can be independently verified by reporters, it shouldn't be published. But did reporters independently verify all the allegations against Hillary Clinton and her allies contained in the emails released by WikiLeaks? And that's the end of that quotation. Well, when you don't have much of a leg to stand on, just divert the attention. Change the subject. We can revisit WikiLeaks, but it's a lousy strategy. Trump does it all the time. Never mind me. Don't look over here. Look over there. Let's talk about Hillary. Journalism failed Ethics 101 this week, folks. It failed badly. In an age of shrinking budgets and advertising revenues, journalists can't afford to drain the only remaining account, their moral credibility account. Sure, some would say it's pretty well depleted already. I don't think so. I think there's still a lot of good journalism out there. And in any case, we need good journalism. We need good, smart, ethical journalism. It's about all journalists have to stand up to Trump, a man with extraordinary media power. Moral credibility is going to be necessary if we're going to have moral authority, if there's going to be such a thing as truth, if there's going to be such a thing as accountability, if there's going to be such a thing as functional democracy. So don't be stupid, journalism. Up your game. You're going to need everything that you've got. Thank you. Men, you've all been there, the women's clothing store, maybe with your wife, maybe your girlfriend. Not that it matters. No one cares how you got there. Certainly not the women, shopaholics, laser-focused on their mission. In the women's clothing store, you look like every dog out front of every Tim Hortons, tethered to the bicycle rack, abandoned and staring vacantly into the empty space. There's no female equivalent. Even the men's clothing store is mostly women, shopping for husbands and sons and God knows probably brothers and uncles, because men are incapable of dressing themselves without creating an international scandal. Oh, but men in women's clothing stores. They're zombies. A sagging robot with near-depleted batteries. A biblical wanderer crossing the vast, hostile desert in search of... In search of what exactly? In search of the oasis. The man's chair. Now, I'm going to let you in on a secret. Not all men are lost in women's clothing stores. Like my idols, Keith Richards, David Bowie, Jimmy Page, Robert Plant. I used to shop in the women's section. Men, have you ever wondered, where do these rock stars get their zany clothing? The answer is, we walk 20 feet over to the women's clothing aisles. I don't know how you missed it. All of our rock idols were literally wearing our wives' fabulous clothing. And because Mick Jagger only weighs 80 pounds, none of the women's clothes ever made his thighs look big, because he doesn't have thighs. Go back and look at the concert footage, and then realize that your heroes, the men who wrote the soundtrack of your life, were all Victoria's Secret models. That's what made them so damn glamorous. Well, time passes and the rock and roll lifestyle gives way to middle age. That's when I started looking for the man oasis instead of a nice stretchy pair of stovepipe cheap Mondays to wear at my next show. Nearly every woman's clothing store has a man's oasis. Usually it's just a chair where the man can sit rather than stand awkwardly in the corner between the camisoles and the leotards like an acne-plagued school bee champion stapled to the wall at the sock hop. I appreciate the effort, really I do. There's nothing worse than a women's clothing store with no man oasis. But look at these chairs, these rigid, plasticky things, one leg conspicuously shorter than all the others. If I'm going to rock, and I don't mean rock and roll because I'm retired from that now, I'd like a good rocking chair. And the table. Someone, presumably one of the women who runs the store, went to a flea market and bought 3 issues of GQ from the 1990s. And maybe one of those magazines with pictures of muscle cars. Now, the stupid men, and yes, that's most of us, unfortunately, don't notice what you're implying with your choice of magazine. But I do. The point is, it's time to modernize the women's clothing store man oasis concept. Time to introduce some governing principles, some specifications, some best practices. Because, you know, it's 2017. Maybe, for example, the man chair could be comfortable with legs that are all the same length. And maybe on the table there could be a copy of The Atlantic featuring the latest article by Ta-Nehisi Coates. For the man who doesn't begin every sentence with, "Hey, dude." They do exist, believe it or not. And maybe next to The Atlantic, a bottle of a nice single malt. An Isla single malt, if possible. We're not picky. A 12-year-old Isla Scotch is just fine by us. Oh, and a lowball glass, made of glass. And some writing paper to make notes while we wait to be asked, "Does this make my butt look huge?" I like a cotton blended writing paper with a watermark. For instance, original Crown Mill finest quality A5 laid paper. It's good because if you use a fountain pen, and I do, the ink won't bleed through the cotton fiber paper. As for bottled ink, J. Erben's Blue Provence would be fantastic, but I'd happily settle for a sepia diamine or a Mont Blanc Noir. Some way to wipe down my pen should I need a refill midway through Elizabeth King's article on race and gender, a short history of the tomboy, would be great. Leather coasters, or really any leather details, would be a nice touch, if you're detail-oriented. I'm detail-oriented, but I also look at the big picture. For the big picture, I'd go with Frida Kahlo. Make sure you get a non-glare glass, museum grade, and an acid-free mount. If there's room, you might consider an ottoman. It's optional, purely optional. An ottoman, by the way, is a great place to use leather, but there's nothing wrong with a jacquard damask. You could do some sort of jaunty interplay between the chair and the ottoman, if you want to be known as the women's clothing store with the jaunty man's oasis. And why wouldn't you? It's all about competitive advantage, market niche, and so on. An entertainment system is a must. That way I can listen to some music while I sip. Oh, I know you have music playing in the store. The music that goes... But I like my own music. And headphones. I'm partial to Grado SR125S. Remember, a good headphone preamp is an essential. You don't have to spend over $1,000, but again, details. And an area rug, obviously. I mean, does it even really have to be said? You have to set off the man oasis aesthetically, or bad feng shui things will happen. I don't actually know anything about feng shui, but from what I've heard, it's temperamental. You don't want to mess with it. I learned everything you need to know about the use of area rugs from The Big Lebowski. And I can't imagine feng shui contradicting that wisdom. The main thing, the critical thing, is that you want a man to be sitting. If he stands, all the blood is pulled down to the feet by gravity. A man's brain needs all the blood it can get to determine if that asymmetrical ruched bandeau tank makes your face look pale. What I want to say, but I don't, is that it looks great on you, but there was a time, honey, when it would have looked fabulous on me. There's going to be a new president. A president who took his campaign slogan from Ronald Reagan, Make America Great Again. The Reagan years was the first pushback of the New Deal on the 1930s, and especially of the Great Society legislation of the 1960s. There isn't much Bill Clinton said that I've agreed with, but he was right about one thing. He once said that you can tell someone's politics by how they see the 1960s. Some think we're worse off as a result of that decade. Some of us think we're better. It's obvious to me that the new president wants to dismantle the New Deal and the Great Society, not just Obamacare or the past 8 years. He's got just the team to do it. Not only his cabinet, but a Congress that includes people like Paul Ryan. Reagan understood television. He was, after all, a celebrity. And he understood politics. He went on TV in 1980 and he asked Americans, "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" They answered him by sending President Carter back to the peanut farm. Every 4 years, Americans ask themselves, "Am I better off than I was 4 years ago?" If Republicans dismantle the health care of Americans, as they're doing as I record this, will Americans feel better off? If President Trump reruns the trickle-down, voodoo economic experiments of the 1980s, will Americans be better off? Since the early days of the Tea Party, I've been thinking about Reagan's question, this idea of being better off. What would even qualify as better off in 2016? Well, in the 1990s, it was the economy, stupid, but I don't think the pocketbook issues can fully account for what's happening in American politics today. I can imagine the president faring poorly on the economic issues, yet remaining popular with his base. The Trump movement, as he likes to call it, is cultural. It's a values and an identity movement. It's tribal. It's us versus them. No, I'm not suggesting that Trump voters all share the same values or the same ethnic nationalist outlook. I'm not saying that they're all racists. I'm not saying that they're all anything. But some of them are cultural warriors. There's no getting around that fact. Some of Trump's supporters define better off as more Christianity, less brown people. He brought out millions who until now had stayed home on election day because conventional American politics is pocketbook stuff, and that doesn't turn their wheels. What does turn their wheels are issues like multiculturalism, feminism, and political correctness, all of which they loathe and abhor. It's a cultural battle, and cultural warriors aren't nearly as interested in deficits and term limits and budgets as they are in, say, religion and race. America has been fighting culture wars most of its history. That's not new. Wars between those who find slavery morally repugnant and those who believe it's just part of God's divine plan. Wars between those who think homosexuality is a biological fact, a product of genetic disposition, and those who think it's a perversion, a lifestyle choice. Wars between those who conceive America as a Christian nation and those who insist upon the separation of church and state. Wars between those who seek a brave new world and those who believe all of our answers are in the past. Zero-sum wars. Wars where compromise is not only difficult, it's undesirable. The Tea Party elected people like Ted Cruz to shut down the machine, not to reach consensus, not to find a win-win, not to look for the broadest possible good. Compromise, for them, is capitulation, an abandonment of ideological purity. The voters have sent to the White House a man who will tear down, dismantle, and destroy. And, yes, he'll build a wall, or he says he'll build a wall, if we were to take him at his word, and I can't quite recommend that, but his word is all we have on a lot of things, he'll return America to some unspecified gray past by a kind of reverse engineering. This isn't a critique or a lament. It's an observation of the obvious, that the Republicans are defined by what they're against. And they're against a lot. I'd say they're against modern society. They don't have a replacement for Obamacare, and they don't seem much interested in ever having one. Will you be better off in 4 years, America? And what does that even mean? I guess we'll see. Well, I have a treat for this week. I decided to sit down and talk to a very interesting person, somebody who I've been following for many years, and he's generously agreed to be with me on the show today, so please welcome Wayne K. Spear. Welcome to the show. Oh, thank you. I'm excited. I think you're brilliant, by the way. Oh, please. But if we're being honest here, I think you're quite underrated, and I'm not just kissing your ass. How could you? You know? Yeah. Okay, so tell the listeners what you're up to these days. Oh, gosh. Keeping busy. A lot of writing, a lot of work, podcasting, you know, stuff.
I do.
Yeah.
You're very
articulate.
It's like we can finish each other's sentences.
Right. So, what's one thing that would surprise people to know about you? I mean, not me, obviously. I wouldn't be surprised.
Right. So, okay. That's a tough one.
Yeah, because you're actually kind of boring.
Oh, sorry.
Right.
I like medieval and Renaissance music.
Oh, God. That is so boring.
Not to me.
You did ask.
I know, but let's keep it to ourselves, for God's sake. I'm not sure why I agreed to this.
Obviously, it's a desperate attempt for attention.
Anyway, what are you looking forward to in 2017?
Launching some projects. I'll be writing for new outlets soon. New for me, I mean. And having interesting guests on this podcast.
Oh God, yes. I look forward to that too.
Okay. And I hope to record a new album in 2017, actually.
No one's interested in that.
Sorry?
Nothing. I think I'm picking up a radio signal or something.
I'm hoping to do some TV and radio work as well.
Man, I did not get much sleep last night.
Do you find you get up in the night to pee more than you used to?
That's kind of personal.
Actually, I have to pee right now.
Where are you going?
I have to pee. Just say goodbye. I'll be back in a few minutes. Say goodbye.
Oh, well. Okay. Goodbye.
Downtown Toronto might soon have an Indigenous business district on the corner of Dundas and Jarvis Streets. Toronto Councillor Kristen Wong-Tam is working with the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation and the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business to secure 1,300 square meters of land near the corners of Dundas and Jarvis Streets in Toronto. This for an Indigenous business district to serve as a gathering place for Indigenous entrepreneurs and as a venue for cultural events. Indigenous people have been here the longest, but you'll not find an Aboriginal BIA that's not tied to a land treaty or a reserve, said Councillor Wong Tam. The idea was spurred by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's final report. Much of that report was speaking specifically to federal governments, provincial governments, territories, and even school boards, says the councillor, but not much was speaking to actions that cities can take. This despite the fact that urbanization of Indigenous people is on the rise. In fact, many Indigenous people today are urban people. I haven't seen the latest statistics, but it's probably about half, if not more. Mississauga of the New Credit First Nation Chief Stacy Laforme says that I think we deserve more diversity, and this district would be a perfect way to show value and respect. Interesting story in the news there. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time on the Roundtable.